National research suggests that up to 15% of incarcerated people experience homelessness in the year before admission to prison, according to prisonpolicy.org. Almost 50,000 people a year enter homeless shelters immediately after exiting incarceration, according to National Alliance to End Homelessness. This is Kristen Shook with Reentry Reframed, a Mirror Inc. sponsored podcast. Today, I have Misty Bosch Hastings as my guest. Thank you very much for joining me, Misty.
Thanks for having me.
I usually like to get started just by kind of getting to know you a little bit. So where are you from?
I'm from here, Topeka, Kansas, my whole life.
Where did you go to school and where did you grow up?
All over the place. I started my education in Topeka. And around third grade, my mom remarried and we moved to Linden, Kansas. And went to school there from third grade till my junior year and then finished high school at Santa Fe Trail in Carbondale.
What was your childhood like?
Rough. Childhood was rough.
Why do you say that?
I was raised by a very traumatized mother, someone who was abused very badly. And my father was an addict, an alcoholic, and not present. It was very traumatic. I almost have a perfect ACE score. Just one short. My dad wasn't in prison while I was growing up, but he was before I was born.
When did you realize that things in your home weren't what they were supposed to be?
Pretty early on. I remember when my parents divorced. I was only 5 years old, but I remember the turmoil, the abuse, the anger. I remember the phone calls, my dad calling my mom to cuss her out and answering the phone and him not knowing it was me that answered. Just a lot of trauma that they brought me into.
When did those things kind of slow down?
When did the trauma slow down?
More so like that life of having to be in the middle of your parents.
That's hard to say when it slowed down. I think as I got older, probably in my early teenage years, I just decided not to engage. Mm-hmm. When I was allowed to make those decisions, I tried. But the conflict never stopped. If it wasn't conflict between my parents, it was conflict with my parent and another person or family members. Yeah, just constant conflict.
How did you deal with that? Do you remember?
I think I dealt with it by becoming a perfectionist and trying to guess everybody's next move and waiting for the shoe to drop, but trying to prevent whatever I could. So, that gave me a lot of great skills today, of course, to be able to read people and perform well and be successful, but it came with a cost.
How was school, like having to deal with that outside of school? How did you perform during school? And was there ever any red flags that your school had caught on to?
I don't think there were red flags because, when you're in that kind of a home, you know what you can and can't say at school. So, no, I don't think that the school was ever cued of anything. But school for me, I think, was an escape when I didn't have to parent my parents or parent my niece and nephews. It was I did enough to get by. Without effort, I was a BC student. If I could have had support, I can't imagine where I would be today.
Were you able to still develop good friendships and everything while you were in school?
Fortunately, my parents were not all bad. They had great friendships growing up, and I saw that and knew how to be a good friend, too. So I actually have several friends today that I had when I was 7, 8 years old. So I've been blessed with good friends.
Did living up in that type of a lifestyle ever lead you into struggling with addiction?
Absolutely. My parents were hippies, I guess is what you would call it. And I was born in the 70s, early 70s. So it was a time when drugs weren't, I don't want to say frowned upon, because I'm sure there were people that frowned upon them. But I feel like it was normal in this culture that I was in to do drugs. And it was normal in my home for kids to do celebratory drugs. I remember a time when I believe it was Mother's Day, maybe, and gathering in my parents' room and them smoking a joint. And I don't know if I hit it properly, but I remember like we were offered this. And so drugs were always around. And it's just something I grew up. And then again, with the parents, mostly the mother that I had, I knew we didn't talk about that outside of, you know, you didn't go to school and talk about it. And I think there was kind of a fear instilled into us that if we told, that we would be taken away. And so didn't talk about that at school.
How many siblings do you have?
I have two older siblings and one younger sibling.
At what point in time do you think that your life kind of started to stabilize?
Stabilization came for me when I had my first child. That's when it started. I always wanted to do better than what was done to me. So I was operating in a way that I was just trying to not do the things that were done to me. And with growth, I started to realize that that wasn't enough. I was still not what I would consider to be a great mom. I didn't get into drugs after I had children, but I drank. And at one point after I lost my dad, I drank heavily. I mean, I was probably drinking 4 to 5 times a week. And one day I just woke up from that and was like, wow, that I woke up on a Sunday around 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And it just hit me that where I was going and that I didn't want to go there. And so I went to a meeting that day and I felt like I didn't really belong there. But it was an eye opener. It was just like, okay, this is where you're headed. And I've never wanted to be in that lifestyle. It just, I had lost my dad and I had no skills to cope with that. And I lost him tragically. You know, the way of what I was raised was you use drugs or you drink and party and everything goes away and you're happy. But it didn't go away. It made things so much worse and, you know, made me somebody that I wasn't proud of. And it especially made me a mom that I just was not wanting to be.
And about how old were you when you had your daughter and then when your father had passed?
When I had my daughter, I was 20 and I never really had any addiction issues or drinking much after that, here and there with family. But then when my dad died, I was 30 and that's when things got out of control.
How long were you drinking heavily before you went to the meeting and kind of got on a different path?
I would say at least a year, maybe 2 years.
And were you working and everything during that time?
I was working. I was working as a bartender, which wasn't helpful. And I was also selling drugs. When I was a bartender, someone approached me and told me, hey, you know, you've got this perfect job. You've got this perfect setup to where, you know, you could sell these things for me and make extra money. And I thought, wow, that's a really great idea. Yeah.
I didn't know this.
Yeah. At the time, it just seemed like, yeah, of course, you know, I'll do it while I'm at work and, you know, no big deal. Yeah.
How long did you do it for?
Oh, wow. About the whole time I was drinking heavily. So about a year, I think.
Did you ever get caught doing it?
No. No, I didn't. And that's really the only difference between me and everybody. That there's no difference. I mean, I just didn't get caught. I didn't do anything wiser or better. You know, I think the Lord just looked out for me. And because I wasn't any sneakier or, you know, just luck and probably my mother praying for me too.
How long did you do that? And then what made you actually stop?
So I think that I sold drugs. I sold drugs over various times in my life. I had family members who sold drugs and I had access to be able to do that. And so when I was done, what happened was I was living in a home in Oakland and I was pretty much done with it, but I still had a lot of negative connections around me. And I had tried, I was working somewhere else. I quit the bar, like I was trying to clean things up, but my house burned down, lost everything. And when I tell you that was the biggest blessing that has ever probably happened to me in my whole life, this home that was just full of hurt, pain to me, to my kids, it was burnt and it was a major reset. I was probably 33, 34 at the time, but it just like picked me up, me and my kids up and put us in a different place around different people. And people didn't have access to me anymore. I didn't have access to those people. And it was hard. I lost my job. I was laid off the same week as my house burned down.
Where were you working?
I was working for Ingruff Catering. I was an office manager. And they closed. So the same week that happened, my house burned down. I worked with these ladies that went to Topeka Bible Church. And these ladies really made a difference in my life. They helped me get housing. They connected me with a landlord who let me paint houses for him to be able to pay the rent. And it was just, life just did a complete 360. It was a wild time.
How did your kids handle all of that?
How did they handle it? You know, I don't know if I can really speak for them. I think that they've definitely had their own trauma from it. And unfortunately, I put a lot on my daughter. So I know that she's had her own struggles from experiencing those things. I definitely learned to do better and to try to mend those relationships with my kids. And I have asked for forgiveness and was forgiven. But that still, it doesn't change what they went through. And they, you know, they've had to deal with their own trauma from my decisions and from what I went through. It's just gets passed along, but a little better, I hope.
When did you have your son?
I had my son when I was 27.
And how was life like then?
It was bad. I was in an abusive relationship and with an alcoholic who was very abusive verbally and physically. So that was a really rough time. And, you know, as far as the effect that that had on my daughter as well, seeing that relationship, you know, that's one of my biggest regrets is the trauma that she experienced from that. But that relationship ended pretty quickly after my son was born and kind of spent the rest of his time at home with me and the rest of my daughter's time at home with me after that, trying to make sure that they were okay. And trying to heal our relationships and really just making them and their happiness my priority.
Were you still living in that house in Oakland?
When I had my son?
Yes. And yep. Then like during that relationship, it was after that had happened? Okay.
Yep. It. So I lived in several places. but in Oakland, that was probably, my son was probably 3 to 4 when I lived there. My daughter, 7 years older than him.
So we'll go back to once things kind of started getting on the better path, once the unfortunate house fire, but it did help you start getting things on track. What kind of services, like I know that you mentioned the services that they helped you with, but could you go a little more in detail of what the process looked like?
So after the fire, we moved into a home that these ladies helped me get connected with, this landlord who was somebody they went to church with. And I was there probably a couple months before I had landed employment. And I remember Christmas was coming up and I had a lot of utilities that I couldn't pay because I wasn't working for anything. I was working for my landlord. Christmas was coming. I was scared to death of not having anything for my kids. I had not experienced a time in my life when I didn't have employment before. I had applied for a position and I was getting it. I had gotten the position, but I was not starting till after Christmas. And it was going to be a fairly decent employment opportunity. But there was a radio station that they do this thing called Hope for the Holidays. And I wrote in because my daughter had said to me, at this time she knew Santa didn't exist. And she had said, if we could just get Mason something so he still believes in Santa, that... Then I was on a mission to make something happen. I remember I went to church that next Sunday, and I think I had 13 cents to my name, 13 cents. And I gave it all. I put it all on the plate, and I just trusted that something was going to happen, and it did. That same day at church, this lady came up to me and said, hey, are you guys doing okay for Christmas? Because I've been wanting to adopt somebody. And I would like to adopt your family. And I couldn't believe it. So she actually got the kids some gifts. But that's not all that happened. I also had written into that radio station, 98.9, and kind of let them know what my struggle was, that I had lost my job, lost my home, and was, you know, that thing that Maddie said about just get Mason something, you know, I didn't want that. So They called me and they ended up paying all my utilities off, gave me a $500 gift card for groceries, and gave me, I want to say like $200 a piece for the kids. And then I was also hired on to clean for somebody. And this all happened within a week. So that was probably the real reset and just the gratefulness that I felt in how strangers invested in me and made a difference in my life and changed the trajectory of my life. I've never forgotten about that. Never.
And how old were you? And then how old was Maddie, also your son, when that happened?
I think at that time, I think Mason was 7 and Maddie would have been 14. And I was 34 or something like that.
What happened after?
So then the job that I was due to start was going okay. And then somebody came into my life. She came in the form of a supervisor. And that was another life-changing ordeal. This woman came into my life and started challenging me. And I think what happened was she recognized things in me that I sure didn't see. I always call it her, she had this Da Vinci code, like a way of dealing with people to make them want to better themselves. I don't know what she did to me, but she had some voodoo Da Vinci code that she saw something in me. She believed in me and she made me believe in myself. She led me through healing myself. She led me through and to therapy, and it just definitely made another big shift in my life when I realized what trauma was and how to start healing from everything.
And did you learn that more so through her, or did you learn that through going to therapy, or both?
Both. Going to work with her was like having a therapist every day. And honestly, still, she's my mentor, and still today, and I still bounce things off of her, and she's still open to that. But had it not been for her and her belief in me, I don't think I would be where I'm at today.
What type of things did she teach you? What were a few of the core beliefs and lessons that you've learned?
I think the biggest thing she taught me was to value myself. She taught me how to recognize my worth. She taught me about the power of transformation.
How was the Medicaid job? Like, what kind of things did you learn working in that field?
The Medicaid job, I learned how to be a leader because of my mentor's investment in me. I don't really recall how much time we had together. It seemed like a lot, but I think it was maybe just a couple of years. But by the time she was moving on to a job in corrections, I took her place as a supervisor. And when she started, I probably was hanging on by the skin of my teeth because I was struggling with being on time and, you know, attendance issues. And so it was, I mean, if it wasn't for that job, and I wouldn't have met her, and I can't imagine where I would be today. But that job afforded me also a change of life. I think I was promoted 4 times in 5 years, and I started making $10 an hour at that job. And when I left, I was making about $80,000 a year. And so it was a great opportunity. Lots of good skills that I learned there about myself and leadership.
Where did you go after that?
So after that, unfortunately, that was a corporate job. And with corporate jobs, there's a lot of office politics. And while I love the work that I did because I love making a difference, there was something that just didn't feel right. I became a chain smoker, and I remember I would leave work and I would have to drive around and calm down after the day that I had almost every day, just so I wouldn't take it out of my kids when I got home. So I'd drive around, smoke, listen to music, and try to decompress before I would go home, and just so that I could, you know, be fair and be present with my kids. So I had just decided after one event that I needed something different. And that same day, I look on the state job listing and I saw this job for homelessness. And it was about writing grants and providing oversight for lots and lots of money. And I had never done anything like that. But I knew about homelessness because my father was frequently homeless. And I loved volunteering at the rescue mission. So I thought, well, you know, that's fulfilling to me. Maybe this will be too. And I applied and I got it. And I kind of knew that I was going to get it. I just felt like, yep, this is me. I'm going. So that's where I went. I ended up being a housing and homelessness project coordinator on the Governor's Behavioral Health Commission. And that also was a great opportunity for me that just helped me level up.
Can you explain some of the projects that you were able to help with?
So one of the projects that I oversaw was called Supported Housing Funds, and it was a state general fund where I was able to help people that are experiencing homelessness through the mental health centers in Kansas. So one thing that happened was there was an individual in Topeka that died that was homeless, that froze to death, and it stirred something in me, and I thought, yeah, we're not doing this again. So I contacted the mental health centers, all 27 of them in Kansas, and I said, this money needs to be used for hotels. If it gets below freezing, I want anybody that's on the streets to be in a hotel. So that was maybe the first winter that I had oversaw that fund. Well, the next winter comes and we're doing the same thing. We're putting people in hotels off the streets for their safety. And then it just stirs a partnership with other agencies in Topeka. The city then moved to So the city started partying.
Save the homeless.
Okay. So the city started a program doing Shelter Plus Care in a housing first model. So we partnered with them we would take people off the streets, put them in a hotel, and then the city would come alongside them and then help them with a housing voucher. And then we had several other agencies who was assisting with this. So the last time I knew about these numbers, this winter that we did this, I want to say 80% of the people that we housed are still housed last time we reviewed that. So that's pretty significant. So then my last project that I did with them was around when COVID hit. The railroad had decided that they wanted everybody that was housed outdoors on their property to leave. So we were trying to figure out where these individuals could go, because we know that the mission isn't the answer for everybody. And so I had asked my agency for funding to house them, and they gave us $100,000 to get these people off the streets and into housing. So we are doing great. We have all these vouchers and we're ready to get these people housed. And then COVID hits. And so Vallejo shuts down their services. But I didn't have those same rules that Vallejo had, so I kept going. I was still housing people. I was picking them up, putting them in my truck and taking them to find housing and look at apartments. And I was just determined to make sure that was successful. And it was. And so we were able to house almost everybody with an exception of maybe 3 to 5 individuals. And we housed them, we furnished their homes, and I did case management as much as I could with COVID going on, keeping myself safe, but was still a fairly successful project. I think not as successful as the first one, because there was no case management for those people. And, you know, we just housed them in a pandemic and services are shut off and a lot of people didn't have phones. It was rough. So the success rate was not there, of course, because their supports weren't there.
Can you explain what Housing First is?
Housing First is just like it sounds. It's housing first with no hoops to jump through. It's housing. You don't have to be sober. You don't have to go to treatment or therapy. Just are treated like everybody else in the world with no expectations. I mean, aside from landlord expectations, you know, everybody deserves housing, and that's what it is.
So how did the people that you served feel and show their gratitude to you knowing that was the situation?
Well, I mean, I'm still friends with them. I'm still friends with a lot of them today. And I actually, that's crazy that you say that, because one of the people just messaged me last night and told me she loved me. And I hadn't heard from her for a while and just got a random message on Facebook just like, I love you, Miss Dan. I'm like, oh, I love you too. So, yeah, I think I built some good friendships.
How does it feel to have been able to impact that many lives?
I don't like to think about that because it makes me cry, Kristen. It's a blessing. I often say that I feel like Santa or Oprah because I get to help people. I mean, I don't have to help me. I get to. It's a blessing. Honestly, don't tell anybody, but the work that I do, I'd probably do it for free. Like, and they pay me to do it. So that's pretty awesome. But it's very satisfying. It's very fulfilling. I am working with somebody right now who's been on the streets for 2 decades, and I have gotten him a housing voucher, and we're slowly moving into this process of getting him off the streets, and he's finally saying yes, and I've been asking for years, so this is big for me. And we were eating lunch together the other day, and he had talked to me previously about having a child that he wanted to get a hold of, and he told me his name, and I found this child, and I told him, I was like, oh yeah, by the way, I found your son, and I added him on Facebook. I didn't tell him who I was or that I knew you, but I wanted to let you know that I found him. And this man started crying, and I was like, oh man, like I'd not seen that side of him. And he's a man of very few words, and I wasn't expecting that. And you know, later that day I was like, wow, like that was super powerful. Like I think what I'm trying to say is that I'm such a doer that I don't think about the impact. I'm doing it because it's the right thing to do, and it's just who I am. I rarely think about, I really changed that life. That's not how my brain works. It's like, life shouldn't be this hard. I'm going to make this easier when I can. And that's kind of how I operate. So
how long did you work at KidAds, and then where did you go after?
So I started working at KidAds in 2016, and I left in 2021, February of 2021. There was something that occurred at KidAds, and something in me felt like it was best if I moved on. So I resigned. Didn't know what I was going to do, but for some reason, I just wasn't worried about it. I was like, well, this is just what I'm supposed to do. Okay, I hear you, Lord. And so I was just waiting and just kind of searching for the next opportunity. And I got a call from Barry Feaker, and he said, hey, I hear that you're looking for a job. And I was like, yeah. He basically just said, well, I have something for you. Can you come in and talk? And I did. And it was a brand new housing program. It was the first time that the Rescue Mission had ever accepted grant money for a housing program. I believe any type of federal money. I think it was the first time we'd ever accepted anything. But I had worked with Barry previously through doing Tent City, housing folks out of there, and just various other homeless things. And Barry was my professional hero. I just think his legacy is amazing. And I love his heart. I love his heart. I love what he has done for our city for the last 35 years.
For those who may not know who he is, will you explain that?
Barry Feaker was the executive director of Topeka Rescue Mission for 35 years.
That's so cool and amazing that you're, like, right after doing grant operations and everything for the homeless, like, literally your opportunity opens up.
Yeah. Yeah, that's kind of how my life goes. It's just like, here's your next thing. And I just go with it. Try not to control things, because I've learned from life that things happen exactly the way they're supposed to, and I just need to chill and go with it.
Will you explain to us how that opportunity has unfolded since accepting it with the Rescue Mission?
Yeah, it's been amazing at the Rescue Mission. I absolutely love what I do. I love the people that I work with. It is so nice coming from a political position to coming into people that like genuinely love and care about you is amazing. So what happened the first year is I helped develop a housing program. I had 2 staff, and the first year I developed the program, and with the help of 2 staff, we housed 160 people. And after 1 year of housing those people, one person was evicted out of 160 people. And again, not getting caught up in those types of details. Other people have asked me, you know, we need the numbers. And so I'm looking, I'm like, is this right? Like, did we really do this well? And the reason I believe it's so successful is because we're able to have relationships with people. And the relationships don't end like they do when you're in other helping agencies. Like you're allowed a certain amount of time to walk along beside somebody. We don't have that. We don't have that barrier at the Rescue Mission. I can take a food box to somebody that I housed 2 years ago, and I can sit there and be a support for them and remove barriers to housing and you know, stop potential homelessness, no matter how long ago they were a client. So that's the piece that is the reason for the success, I think. And we're still growing, still changing things. We wrote a grant that is potentially going to allow me to have a SOAR case manager on my team. And that will kind of wrap up the last piece that we don't have covered at the mission. Because we take people in. As soon as they come in the door, they get a case manager. That first initial case manager meets all their needs. And then they move on. They prepare them for housing. Now, the missing piece is when you have somebody who comes in who is severely mentally ill and has no income. And, you know, there's not much or any options for housing for them. So by having a SOAR case manager on staff, they'll be able to help them with Social Security and Medicaid and get them a source of income so that we can house them. So that's kind of the last piece to the perfect program that we're creating there.
What message do you have for individuals in our society who think down on homeless individuals?
That's really hard to answer, because if someone is looking down on someone who's experiencing homelessness, I have a feeling that their self-awareness probably isn't real great, because anybody who really has lived in this world and experienced loss of any kind or trauma of any kind probably knows that it could take just one bad break to put you in their same position. I mean, by all rights, I should be on the other side of my desk. I mean, perfect A score, all kinds of trauma, all kinds of addiction, sexual abuse, everything that I've experienced should put me at the homeless camp. But I know that there was people that came in and helped make a difference in my life. But I can't imagine that someone has a life so perfect that they can't relate a little bit. So I guess I would just ask them to look inside and search for that thing that happened that could have done you in, because not everybody has those people that are safe places to fall. And not everybody has the supports that some of us had that made a difference. And that's really what it is. And it could always be us still today, even healed, even some of the people that we're seeing coming through the doors are elderly people that ran out of money, that don't have family and can't afford to pay. So, you know, that's going to be us. If we live that long, that could be us too. Like, there's not any one opinion that's correct about homelessness. It's made up of so many things.
What does reentry mean to you in your field of work?
Reentry, what we see a lot are the individuals coming out of corrections who kind of don't have those supports, who don't have family that they can come home to get a new start. But what they have when they come through the doors of where I work is a support and a ton of resources. And I mean, that's emotional support, educational, career, housing, kind of the whole shebang.
And if you could kind of guesstimate, about how many individuals do you think come through your doors that have a criminal background?
Of the people that I see, I would say 90 to 95% have a criminal background. Because I house everybody that goes through our program, we have to know those things. And there's nothing that keeps somebody from coming to the mission. Sex offender, violent offender, we don't turn them away. We don't turn anybody away. It's a soft place to land for everybody.
What is one story that changed your outlook on the work that you do and motivated you to never give up?
I don't get caught up in like, oh God, that was such a success for me.
You're right.
So that's hard. The reason I keep doing what I'm doing and I don't give up, the reason I started volunteering with the homeless, it happened after I quit drinking. When I realized that I wanted to honor my dad in a way that he would be proud of, I started volunteering at the rescue mission. And that was my way of being close to him and doing something that would have been meaningful to him. So that's kind of what led me back to where I'm at today. As far as my why, my life has been all these really hard lessons that gave me a lot of really great resources. So there's just something about this line of work that I'm really good at what I do because I've been there. And the reason I keep showing up is because God just keeps giving me what I need to be successful. And he keeps opening doors and, you know, he keeps refining the work that I do, refining me. It just feels right still.
What needs to be done to truly change the number of individuals who face homelessness?
We need more options. The rescue mission is an amazing option, but it is not for everyone, and it's by their choice. There needs to be a no barrier shelter, no barrier transitional housing, something that people can go to directly from the streets if they're still addicted to drugs, still need to use, somewhere safe for them to go. There's lots of examples all over the United States where something like that is working, and we just need that option too.
Let's do it.
Let's do it. I'm in.
How big of a building do we need?
We really don't even need a building. We just need the space. I think the tiny home type model is the best option. I mean, we have the land for it. Unfortunately, the only thing that we don't have is the community. I mean, there's people that are willing to give the land. I mean, it would be, I believe, and my belief is it would
How many tiny homes do you think need?
I would say 50. I would say 50 would do it. If we had 50 tiny homes that were no barrier, that were staffed, and maybe it was in a gated community where they had lockers, where they could keep things that they needed that they couldn't take inside, like drugs. I think people are getting caught up in that we are enabling people, but that's not what this is. But anyways, that would be an option to get people off the streets. That would take care of all the garbage that people freak out about. You know, that's a big reason that people hate the camps is because of all of the garbage. Well, they don't have trash cans and they don't have a washer and dryer. So they wear their clothes until they can't possibly wear them anymore. And then they get different clothes. And so the cleanliness is a big part of the problem for the community. If we could do something about that, you know, that tiny home village would offer that. I think it would be so much easier for all of us to come out and wrap our supports around those individuals. I mean, you know, it'd be a lot safer than us going down into the camps where we're basically invading their homes and they have access to weapons right there, you know. And I've spoken to many street homeless individuals who, when we thought that was something we could do previously, they were excited about it. You know, there's a gentleman I'm helping right now that's been homeless for decades. His arthritis is so bad he can barely walk, and the cold is just ripping him to shreds. But because of his mental illness, he can't stay at the mission. He refuses, and I wish that he would, and he's more than welcome, but he can't do it. And I understand that. I do. As somebody with anxiety and panic disorder, I get it. But that's how bad it is that he don't want to be around people because of his mental illness, that he's basically crippled in his camp because he's so cold. And I'm trying. He does have a voucher. I'm going to get him out of there. But we need that meantime option between the camp and the house. Are you on fire? We doing this?
Yeah, I'm doing abracadabra. Because that's just, I don't know how exactly, but by golly, when's our timeline date?
Let's give it a year.
A full year?
Full year.
Okay.
What's the date today? Let's just shoot for December 1st of 2023.
Is it December?
No, tomorrow. It's going to be a Christmas miracle, Kristen.
Oh, yeah, let's do it.
Let's do it.
What?
I believe we can.
All right. So you guys heard it here first. Got to hold us accountable. Or you can donate funds. Yes. Or tiny home skills.
And talk to your city. That's really the only holdup, is that we need the city to be okay with allowing us to have tiny homes. Right now, the reason that they're not okay with it is because they're smaller than what's allowed for a home.
Even if it's footage on somebody's private land.
Right. Because I don't think that anything else that we're trying to do would be an issue. That is the only barrier that I'm aware of. I really honestly believe that there would be people who would sponsor one tiny home. Mm-hmm. We found these things, I think they were around $5,000. And they would keep people warm or cool and safe and dry.
What programs are currently available for those who are homeless, in poverty, or in the process of reentry? Through the Rescue Mission, Vallejo, and partnerships.
Topeka Rescue Mission offers several programs, whether somebody is in the Rescue Mission or not. So I think it's important for people to know how many programs that Topeka Rescue Mission offers and is a part of. I had no idea until I worked there, everything that happens there, and it's massive. So the programs that I oversee are guest management for people that are at the Rescue Mission. I also oversee career readiness and education. That program helps individuals get ready for the job market, practice their resume, practice work skills, work etiquette. And we can train people like in different things like OSHA. There's OSHA safety trainings. We can help connect individuals to employment. And then we also have a housing department. We have some funding to help individuals find housing, obtain housing, and sustain housing. We have homeless prevention funding. We also have a food bank where people can come twice a month, and that's every Tuesday and Thursday when somebody's in our program. Like if they started with us at the mission, we will for 1 year offer that home delivery of food boxes to them. Also, if people are still in the community and maybe they're unsheltered, they can use the mobile access partnership on Tuesdays and Thursdays as well. And there's a ton of resources there too, not just a shower and laundry, but also other Vallejos there, Stormontville. They can get hot meals, lots of services available there. I would encourage people in corrections that might be, a lot of agencies drop people at the doors. Then we kind of have to start with them cold start. It would be nice if people did like a warm handoff. I would encourage people that maybe are discharge planners to reach out to me and for us to work together to do a better discharge plan than sending somebody in a taxi, which I probably shouldn't say that. Sending somebody in a taxi to the mission or just dropping them off at the doors. I feel like we could do better. And that's something that's on my list of to-dos, is to build better partnerships with discharge planning.
I agree. That is one thing that I know that Topeka and a lot of the social services is working on, is building a more cohesive system that works together. Mm-hmm. If you could tell your younger self one thing, what would it be?
It's going to get better. Probably it's going to be better than you can even imagine.
What are three words that best describe you?
I don't know. You tell me.
Come on, man. No. I'm asking you.
Three words that describe me. I care. Caring, transformed, hopeful.
I knew you were going to say that. So, with that, what does hope mean to you?
Hope means the belief that there's always something better available, that nothing is going to stay stuck or not going to stay in pain. It's going to get better.
What is one message of inspiration you have for others?
Nothing is as bad as it seems, ever. Bad things happen. Look for the lesson and take those lessons and just keep building. Keep building, keep making better choices.
How can others help advocate for those who are facing homelessness?
If someone isn't good at advocating for themselves, they definitely need somebody else to advocate for them. Find somebody who knows what the resources are. And I'm that somebody. I can be that somebody. And there's a lot that you're that somebody. There's a lot of people that know. If you care about somebody who's experiencing homelessness or at risk of homelessness, don't give up. Call everybody. You're going to hit somebody. A lot of us are in this field because we care. It is not for the money. We're in this field because we know what it's like to be on the other side and we want to pull people out. Just be annoying. Call people. You know, squeaky wheel. Squeaky wheel gets the grease. I do want to share that while I don't believe we can cure homelessness because things are always going to happen, I believe that the state and especially this community has the capacity and the remedies to change homelessness. We can make it more brief and we can make it one time if we work better together and we have a couple more options. I think that it would be pretty amazing. And I think it's completely doable. Dr. Samson Bars is creator of Housing First. And he told me that we could remedy homelessness in Kansas. And I was like, word, I believe you. Like, I totally believe you because I've seen higher level, the funding that we have to do so. I've seen all the different silos of people willing to help. And over the past few years, I've seen the changes. The changes are coming. People are working together. It's completely possible. And Kristen and I are going to, we're going to do it.
Yep. We've been on this mission for at least 3 years, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I've helped here and there, but like,
Think it's about the money. I really don't think it's about the
exactly,
money.
Exactly. But it is how to get the money.
Yeah.
By next year, December 1st, 2023.
Grand opening.
Tiny village. No barrier entry. Anyways, would you leave your contact information for anybody who would like to reach out to you, either for the resources that you have a hand on for everything, or also planning to work better together?
My phone number is 785-414-0700. My email is mbosch, B-O-S-C-H, hyphen, Hastings, H-A-S-T-I-N-G-S, @trmonline.org.
Thank you.
Welcome.
I love all the work that you do. I enjoy being able to be a part of it and being able to lend a helping hand whenever possible. And if anybody who is listening to this episode would like to spend some time volunteering, getting out in the field, or just learning a little bit more, please reach out to me or Hastings, or me or Hastings, who are cool. Me or Misty.
That's what she called me when we played football together. Thanks, Shook.
Welcome.
Good game.
Definitely reach out to Misty or myself. And she also actually started a Facebook group. Would you say what the title of that is?
Yes, it's Volunteers Helping Topeka's Homeless. And that Facebook group is specifically for people that want to help the homeless. And it can be any kind of thing. I put needs out there and miraculously they all get met. And it can be volunteering. It can be looking for a mattress or pans or handing out Christmas bags to the homeless. There's a lot of needs. So yeah, that's Volunteers Helping Topeka's Homeless on Facebook.
Thank you for tuning in. As always, let me know what you thought about the episode. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. You can send me an email at kshook@mirroring.org. That's mirroring.org. This is Kristen Shook signing off of Reentry Reframed, a Mirror Inc. sponsored podcast.